Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to Meet the Professor, as today we talk about the management of ovarian cancer with Dr. David O'Malley from The Ohio State University. We have a great faculty for this program, and later on we'll show you the results of a survey we did of the faculty of their usual treatment practices. As with all our webinars, we encourage you to send in questions or cases, and we'll talk about as many of these as we can if you put them into the chat room. We put out a one-minute pre-meeting, a post-meeting survey. We'd really appreciate you taking that. You'll get a lot more out of the webinar as well. We do webinars all the time, and next Tuesday we'll be continuing our series on AML and MDS with Dr. Rabose. And then on Thursday, Dr. Van Cutsem will be talking with us about the management of gastroesophageal cancers. Of course, the big ESMO meeting, that's actually where Dr. O'Malley is right now in Madrid, is about to get started. We have another GI program coming up with Dr. Klempner from MGH on November the 16th. And then we head out for our annual trek to the San Antonio Breast Cancer Meeting. The December 5th through 7th, we'll be doing three satellites there. And then we'll be jumping over to the ASH meeting as well on the next day on Friday, December the 8th, where we'll be doing four of these meetings. If you're around at the ASH meeting or San Antonio, come on by. If not, check it out online. And then we're really excited that next March, we're going to start back up a program we did before the pandemic, weekend-long CME in Miami. And the next March should be a lot of fun. We know a lot of people end up listening to our programs, including our webinars. If you're into podcasts, check out our Oncology Today series, including a recent program with Dr. Moore on ovarian cancer. We're really excited to work with Dr. O'Malley today to talk about ovarian cancer. As we always do, just a caveat to start, we're really going to try to analyze benefits and risks here. In some situations, we'll be talking about off-label use, so please keep that in mind. As we do in all of these Meet the Professor programs, we're going to spend a great deal of time talking about cases from the community, docs in practice, gynecologic oncologists, medical oncologists, and we have short one-minute videos, and hopefully we're going to be able to present eight cases for Dr. O'Malley's short feedback. Here's where we're heading today. We're going to start out, reflect back a little bit on what we've been doing the last couple of weeks, including last Saturday in Las Vegas. And then we'll jump into new approaches to ovarian cancer. Of course, we're going to talk about PARP inhibitors, a bunch of other things. And we have a pretty extensive appendix, including a bunch of papers from Dr. O'Malley that we may or may not be able to cover all of them. I'm sure not all of them, but check it out. So, Dave, just to tell you a little bit about last weekend in Las Vegas. Actually, the weekend before, we were with the Florida Cancer Specialist. I think you've been involved with them as well. We did a day-long program. And then last Saturday, we did another day-long program covering different topics. We also covered gynecologic cancers with your colleagues who we've worked with you and them so many times, Dr. Brad Monk and Dr. Katie Moore. We were talking not just about ovarian cancer, but also cervical, where, of course, we've got a big paper coming up there on tisotumab vedotin at ESMO, and also endometrial cancer and all the crazy things that happened this year at the SGO meeting. So as we go through this, I'm going to extend it since their thoughts are really fresh in my mind, along with the sphere that I went to the night before, and that's another story. But as we go through some of these cases, I'm going to reflect back because I was asking them and I was saying, hey, I'm working with Dave on Tuesday. I'm going to compare what you say to what he said. The one thing we didn't have any cases of, but I really wanted to get your take, and this seems to be coming up over and over, and this was presented, I think, by Brad, was the data on HER2-positive disease, not just ovarian cancer, but this big basket trial that was just recently presented at the ASCO meeting that included, as you can see there on the top, HER2-positive and what we would call HER2-low cervical, endometrial, and ovarian cancer. And as been seen, we did another session on Saturday on biliary tract cancers. You know, you see here biliary also with some responses. But Dave, can you kind of review a little bit of what we know about the incidence of HER2 positivity in gynecologic cancers, including ovarian cancer? what we've been seeing in terms of responses to TDXD and what your experience is, if any, with TDXD right now in gynecologic cancers. It looks like you're seeing responses like we see in other tumors, including maybe the issue of HER2 low. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I think as we look at this, we've really dismissed HER2 new overexpression outside of uterine serous cancers, NGYN. But what we're finding is we're using the previous, in the past, the breast cancer 2 plus, and we get FISH, and only really considered those intermediates then plus FISH versus 3 plus is positive. And those rates of the positivity are a lot lower when we look in the GYN cancers. But when we start including all the 2 pluses, not needing FISH positive, and you see, and we'll talk a little bit more, you know, 1 plus may offer us a really good target. So in endometrial serous, we know that rate's about 35 plus or minus 5%. But when we start looking at other high-grade types of uterine cancers beyond the serous, we see similar expression rates, especially particularly when we go on the lower ends. Cervix is probably more rare, probably on the lower end of that 15-ish percent plus or minus. But again, depending on how you're using what you're considered positive. And over, we did a huge trial way back in the old GOG where we also required that positive based on the breast cancer data. And we only found about 10% of patients. But when we took those that had any positivity, 1 plus or higher, it was more like 35%. Now, most of these HER2 positive patients, however you define it, 1, 2, or 3 plus, are going to not be in the high grade serous. So in our rare tumors, clear cell, mucinous, endometrioid, this is a great option. But I have to admit, Neil, I'm testing everybody right now. Every patient with a recurrent metastatic disease is getting an IHC HER2 new test, HER2 new on these patients. And we're seeing responses that go with these response rates, which were reported. I do want to be a little bit temper our enthusiasm. We've seen a lot of trials, response rates, 35 to 40% in small 40-patient trials that don't seem to bore that out in larger phase 3. But I think as we start to use this in other trials as well as off-label, NCCN recently put that as a 2A category for uterine cervix for 2 and 3 plus, we're seeing that in our experience. It's similar to what's reported here.
So, yeah, we're seeing TDXD pop up in interesting places. I think about a week and a half ago, I was mentioning this gastroesophageal program we did. We had a patient presented who had squamous of the esophagus, where you're not supposed to see HER2 positivity. It was a patient who actually was brought over by his children from Vietnam to Southern California. They found he was HER2 positive, had a complete response, including the brain, which was an amazing case. The patient still in remission, never had radiation surgery. So it's like popping up a lot of places. And here, you know, some of the duration you saw there, ovarian, 18 responders, most more HER2 3 plus, but some 2 plus. So just something to keep your eye on. But now we want to kind of jump into some of the other topics. And I thought it'd be interesting to begin with kind of an interesting question. Really gets into the issue of the management of patients who have advanced metastatic disease and receive all the therapies that are, you know, approved and beyond, and still yes, good performance status. And particularly, what are the, really to jump in before we get into current treatment, like what are the trials out there right now that are exciting? In the last webinar, we were talking about a doc who had written in who was actually a patient who somehow got on this RNA vaccine trial at Dana-Farber. And so I just want to get, I know you're so deeply involved with new agents of research, your thoughts on what are some of the most interesting developments. And I thought one of the ways we could get into it is with a case. This is from Dr. Chase, and she brought up something that I wasn't aware of about this patient, 79-year-old, very, very vibrant, active woman, but who's already gone through 5 lines of systemic therapy. Here's Dr. Chase.
She's biomarker negative. I recommended hospice for this patient, but you know, she contemplated it for a while, but her performance status is still good. She tells me again on the phone, Dr. Chase, I feel better than I've ever felt. You know, traditionally this would be a hospice patient, but she really wants to pursue further treatment. Unfortunately, the thing with these patients, you know, she's sixth line, she's not eligible for trial. So I think, assuming that these experts are on these study planning committees, why do they go based on line of therapy instead of performance status? I think that she would be a great clinical trial patient. Her performance status is excellent. So what would they do with her? And then the second question is, when do you repeat tumor profiling? And if you do repeat tumor profiling at this point, is there a specific result that would change your approach? She doesn't have a bowel obstruction. She doesn't have tensicitis. Her performance status is good. She's essentially like the primary caregiver for her husband who's ill. She sounds great. She's energetic and motivated, but she's not eligible for trial just based on her line of therapy.
So first point, and I asked Katie and Brad this, I said, is that really true? I can't believe it. And they said, yes, which I never heard. So any thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, right away is most of our phase three, phase two trials limit to 1 to 4, 1 to 5 prior, okay? When we're looking at this, there are possibilities to find trials beyond that 1 to 4, 1 to 5 prior. And some trials even limit to 1 to 3 prior. We're looking in trials where we need to have a homogeneous population of patients. And that's why we need to sometimes limit the number of prior therapies. You're right. We need better criteria. You, Dr. Chase. Now, many sites have phase one programs. In the phase one trial, some of the most exciting agents, you have one that we're going to talk about. One of the most exciting agents that I've worked with is a phase one with, there are parts of the trial which are unlimited prior therapies. And you just put up ubamatamab, which is a bispecific MUC16, which is the CA125 molecule, bispecific, connects to MUC16, then has a CD3 arm, which brings in those immune cells. Now, it's somewhat intensive trial, so you have to have a very motivated patient. Dr. Chase, I would love to see that patient in Columbus, Ohio, to participate in our phase one program. There are possibilities. Talk with your phase one docs around your centers or around the area. Sometimes great possibilities for those patients.
I just kind of want to get your macro view in terms of your level of excitability. Imagine you've got this patient who's in really good shape, is, you know, desperate for something that has something that looks exciting, maybe for them. How about nanivaximer pick?
Oh, you did better than I would. I'm going to call it Ovovac because Ovovac is a lot easier to say, right? And so this is a really interesting trial. This is enrolling. Enrolling across the country. I think there's about 30 sites that if they're not active, they will be, okay? One of the most exciting aspects of this trial is it's challenging this previous premise of platinum resistant, which we've gone away from. Now we say platinum ineligible. We know patients who have classically been defined as platinum resistance recur within 6 months of their last platinum, particularly if that has happened beyond the first line, will respond to platinum. So everybody in this trial gets platinum. And Ovovec is a very interesting immune modulator that seems to be in this paper, the phase two data, phase one to phase two data is really thought-provoking, really impressive results. Now you have to have a patient who can get intraperitoneal chemotherapy, and that's one of the biggest challenges, but it's only 2 infusions. And you have a patient you'd be comfortable giving platinum to. And for me, that's anybody who's responded to a prior platinum. So again, very interesting, unique delivery into the abdominal cavity, but some amazingly maybe overstated, really exciting results in some of the earlier phase trials.
How about relacorilant?
Well, you know, I mean, to your point in a conversation we had earlier tonight, right, which is these unique mechanisms, we really don't understand so much about advanced recurrent cancer. For example, in ovarian cancer, we know there is a hormonal, we think there is a hormonally impactful impact in our ovarian cancer, either from a pathogenesis standpoint or potentially treatment. So this drug is actually blocking that mechanism. So we're giving everybody, and that's why we're using nab-paclitaxel here, so we don't have to get as many steroids, because we don't want to interfere with the glucocorticoids. Okay, and so when we're doing that, we're really looking at nab-paclitaxel for everybody, plus or minus relacorilant, which is again this the hormonally based treatment and blocking, and some again really interesting data in smaller trials.
So this is a paper that you and your colleagues put together that really kind of gets into what I'm bringing up here. Deborah Richardson, we work with quite a bit also. And there's also a listing of a whole bunch of trials in there, more novel agents just for people to get aware of. I wanted to just bring up one other issue because I found another paper that I wish we had more stuff to talk about with this topic. I thought it was really interesting. Malnutrition, sarcopenia, and cancer cachexia. I thought also, not just from the point of view of quality of life, which is something you get into with this paper, but also thinking about a patient like this who wants to be proactive. You know, you're talking about hospice to a person who's out, you know, doing, you know, exercising, et cetera. Maybe offering more active lifestyle intervention, even with the hope that not just quality of life, who knows, maybe even, you know, longevity, et cetera. I really recommend this paper. It really goes into a lot of stuff we rarely talk about. We're going to talk about a lot more. But just to get your global thoughts, and in particular, what are some of the interventions you at Ohio State have been looking at? And in particular, how do patients respond to this? I would think that it would be very appealing.
So I tell you what, Molly Morton, one of our fellows, did a great job. And Laura Chambers, one of my junior partners, junior to me, I'm an old man, you know. So, you know, they came to me and they're talking to me about, they want to really get this information out. And I'm kind of like, oh, this is soft science. And I said, you know, we need interventions. And they said to me, Dr. Malley, there is interventions. I said, well, let's put this together in a review paper. Let's really get the information out there, which shows that not only do we need to be developing new agents to fight this cancer, and you know my passion for that, Neil, right? You know, developmental therapeutics, new agents, let's get this done. But what else can we do? What used to be frustrating to me is these papers would say, oh, yeah, cachexia is bad and patients do worse. Okay, I know that. Patients losing a bunch of weight. Tell me what I can do for that patient to help them. And there is, right? Weight, exercise, physical therapy. We do not involve our physical therapists nearly enough. How about a nutritionalist, higher protein diet, more caloric intake to overcome that increased mechanism that they're using to fight that cancer and to recover from their therapy? How about therapies? Progesterone-based therapies that help with the appetite, antidepressant medication, steroids, again, boosting the appetite, potentially helping patients. So when we're looking at this, what used to be frustrating to me is it just one more paper that said these patients do worse. Now let's figure out interventions, and we're doing it. Yoga. It's one of the only interventions across the board, randomized phase 3 trials, improved outcomes, improved tolerance to chemotherapy, stretching, breathing. How can you go wrong? You know, really important interventions. We need to do a better job as practitioners getting our patients involved.
All right. Well, let's get into some cases that really kind of involve treatment today, available treatments. So we're going to talk about some cases related to PARP inhibitors. Before we get started with this first case, though, Alma in the chat room wants to know whether or not there's an increased risk of MDS in patients with CHIP, and do you screen for CHIP in patients who are you're thinking about PARP maintenance or consider that?
It's a great question. Our understanding of this, it does seem that there's an increase, and we haven't started screening. It's a great, great question. We need to do a better job identifying patients with the highest risk of MDS and AML. I work with a wonderful medical oncologist at OSU who's seeing these patients in her clinic. When we start to see some abnormalities in the hematologic values, we need to get it more proactive than that. Should we in the future be testing patients before we put them on PARP inhibitors? Now, what happens if we have a BRCA patient and they're shown to have a higher risk of MDS or AML? So the current time, that's not considered within what I would consider within the standards of therapy, but there are prospective databases, University of Washington starting one. We have a practitioner at Ohio State has an interest in this. So we are getting more information, but we still have a long way to go. Great question.
You got great heme people there at Ohio State. You got like the all-star team for CLL there. Another quick question from the audience. We used to get this a lot more a couple months ago from Fadi, which is how are platinum shortages affecting treatment of ovarian cancer? And what do you, I kind of am hearing, actually, this doc who's about to present the case was talking about this with another case that it seems like it's getting better. So first of all, what did you do? What do you do or what did you do when you couldn't get carbo or even cis? And how are things going right now nationally in terms of that?
Well, you know, I'm spoiled at the third largest cancer center in the country, Neil. And so I have resources and I'm spoiled. I have an amazing group of pharmacy colleagues that are working, calling every connection they have across the country. And so we never had to limit it. We had a conversation and we said we may have to. So we had a working group in place meeting weekly, but we never had to hold off on patients. But there were some institutions or some groups around the country who did. And I think when we really came down to it, even though many of us are in competition within the same regional area, we shared patients when that happened. We made sure those patients got curative intent therapy, overall survival improving therapy. And I was really amazed at hearing some of these stories. It seems that we're past that now. I'm not hearing nearly as much about it. Now we have pegliliposoma doxorubicin, which is a problem, but we're not really seeing the problems with platinum, thank goodness, because we have clear survival advantage with those therapies across multiple solid tumors.
All right, well, let's get to this first case. And I was curious when you referred to yourself as an old man. I think that this case it brings up some interesting questions related to the elderly. And kind of, I wanted to put these first two cases together. You thought, keep in mind the 79-year-old we just talked about, PSA zero, you know, wants new therapy. So this is a lady who, let me just read the beginning. I didn't want to put everything in the video. When she presented, very healthy, rarely doing yoga, aerobic exercise, presents with widely advanced ovarian cancer, extensive intra-abdominal disease, and liver mets, biopsy-proven high-grade serous carcinoma of the ovary, CA-125 over 30,000. And the patient says, I'm an older person, and I really don't want to be treated. I'm ready to be kept comfortable and go into hospice. Any thoughts about that kind of scenario? I'm sure you've faced that on occasion. People walk in and say, no way I'm ever going to get chemo or anything like that. Any thoughts about that as it relates to a case like this and a patient, very elderly patient with metastatic disease?
And I think it has to come down to that conversation, and patients have the autonomy to make that decision. You know, I think it's important we're not paternalistic in that decision. Say, oh, you're 84. You know, I used to not, when I was in training, we didn't operate anybody in their 70s. Then it became, well, the 80s. And now it's really, we have the conversation. If they're not too high risk of a surgery, we're going to offer them, you know, a potentially curative surgery, potentially improved quality of life. In this case, we're not talking about surgery, we're talking about chemotherapy. So for me, sit down with them. What are your wishes? What do you want? How do you want to live out the rest of your life? Let me tell you about carboplatin. Everybody thinks and are freaked out that you're going to be thrown up in the bathroom. You're going to feel miserable. Listen, many patients find that carboplatin and paclitaxel, excuse me, I didn't mean to use the trade name, paclitaxel, is actually quite well tolerated and actually can improve quality of life by decreasing your disease burden. In addition, this patient's really interested because she has a germline BRCA2 mutation. So we know that her response to platinum is going to be a lot harder. And oh, by the way, if she can then get a PARP inhibitor, she's about a 47% chance of potentially being cured of her advanced stage ovarian cancer with treatments that are oral.
So, yeah, it's interesting because actually when she presented at that point, when she said, I don't want treatment, she didn't know she was BRCA2, but Dr. Chotsky taking care of her daughter who had breast cancer and was known to be BRCA2. So she already knew, kind of thought of what was going on. And the other kind of interesting clue, and my point here is if this woman telling you, well, you know, I'm ready to die, et cetera, she had also turned down a knee replacement surgery a few months before this for the same reason. that she was old and ready to die. And that doesn't, you know, when you think about the typical patient in their late 70s, I'm not sure that that shouldn't ring a little bell. And it did ring a bell for this doc that maybe something else was going on, you know, that was contributing to this woman's sense of doom or desperation. And I wonder if she said the same thing to a primary care doc, whether she would have even gotten to a medical oncologist. Here's what happened.
On the first visit, she had said, I'm 78 years old. I have children. I have grandchildren. I have lived my life happily. I don't want to consider any treatment. On the second visit, I tried to convince her to consider low-dose chemotherapy. She agreed to try one dose of weekly carboplatin with paclitaxel. She tolerated very well, and she said, okay, maybe I can do one more, and then one more. Her CA-125 came back to normal with four cycles of chemotherapy regimen. Her scans had significantly improved, and all those visible metastatic disease has almost kind of disappeared. Her daughter had been my patient, and she was treated for early breast cancer. And we knew with the fact that she was BRCA2 positive, and she was BRCA2 positive as well. She has been on niraparib as a maintenance treatment since then, which was in 2017. The recent restaging workup have not shown any evidence of disease. And she's still on 100 milligram niraparib. So the questions to the thought leaders are, would they recommend continuing maintenance niraparib? She has gone to many visits, include visiting her two different sons in two different states, and her brothers in different states, and her family in India. Her medical problem was arthritis. She was hesitant to go for knee replacement surgery like 5+ years ago. She said, oh, I'm 78. What to do with the knee replacement? And now finally she decided to go at age 84. And she has recovered well.
Wow.
So I was very impressed.
Isn't that cool?
I was pretty impressed by it. Amazing story. Yeah. You know, the other thing, you kids learn so much from cases. As I was watching her talk, I thought of something I never thought of when I was talking with her, which was, why wasn't the mother screened when the daughter was diagnosed? Maybe because she was 75 or whatever. You know, maybe people don't think about the parents. Any thoughts about the case?
I mean, so many thoughts. I'll keep it brief. But, you know, she identified that, you know, the knee pain was really impacting her quality of life. And so when we're looking at this, you know, getting into, you know, why do you not want to do anything? Well, because my knee hurts so bad, it's not worth living. Okay, let's take care of that. The other thing is, you know, how long are we going to continue therapy? I really stick with what the clinical trials are. 2 years for laparib, 3 years for niraparib. And a lot of that's because the work, you know, we just published on the ARIEL-3, which, you know, in platinum sensitive data, we continue indefinitely finding and looking at most of the patients who developed AML and MDS were on therapy for more than 3 or 4 years. So that really reiterated in my mind that I want to keep those therapies in the first line to 2 to 3 years.
Your colleague Saturday said 2 years, period, for anything, including niraparib, incidentally, which, you know, it's hard to argue.
I think that's, yeah, it's not unreasonable. Again, I try to stick with where the data is, and the data is would be 3 years. You know, we're looking at designing a trial. We're looking at designing a trial about de-escalating the length of treatment. I can't say much more than that, but I'll just say that there's some conversations out there with regards to that. And that's something that maybe we need to look at. Maybe it needs to be less than 2 years or less than 3 years, and we'll still get the same benefit.
So a word about MDS and AML, because I read an interesting, you had this paper, I think it was the same one you just referred to, the exceptional responder. Yeah. So what was really cool, you saw Deb Armstrong as one of the faculty for our series here, because we work with her a lot. But you published the paper that you just talked about, looking at the exceptional responders. And she sent a letter in saying, when you look in there, she was trying to connect the exceptional responders and duration of PARP with the incidence of MDS. She brought up the whole FDA thing. Then you did a response. It's really great stuff. It's in this slide deck for people who want to read it. But what's the bottom line in terms of, you know, that and your vision for the risk of AML and MDS and its car, you know, what the explanation, you in your response went through a number of potential reasons why, for example, survival in the later stage diseases that was worse might have been, that might have been the case. But can you kind of just summarize globally what came, what you, where you are right now with this whole area?
Well, I'm going to go down to, I'm going to start small and go more global here. Usually I start global and burn it down. But Deb, one of the things that Dr. Armstrong asked is like, hey, your BRCA patients had a higher level MDS. Is there something with regard to the germline mutation? And I love that she wrote that letter because that allowed me to dive deeper into the data. Now, the challenge here is this is right when Clovis was claiming bankruptcy. So getting to this data took a lot of work on the people who were still left at the company, a lot of push from our side. And basically, we found that the BRCA, again, small numbers, descriptive analysis here, right? BRCA was not a risk factor for AML and MDS. But those patients were on for longer with more prior lines of platinum, which are risk factors, okay? So what came away with almost all the patients who developed MDS and AML were on for more than 3 to 4 years, okay? And so when we look at the dose intensity, the number of potential mutations which would be occurring, in my mind, I start thinking about treatment beyond 2 to 3 years were increasing the rate. Again, this is looking at this, you know, in the big picture. I have now a conversation to your earlier point. When I have patients who are on PARP inhibitor beyond 2 years in the current setting, depending on how they're doing, should we stop therapy? The trials went until progression or toxicity. But now I say we have to balance with the risk of AML and MDS. Now, there are many patients who say, I have a recurrent disease. This disease is, when it recurs, will ultimately get me. Why would I stop this therapy? I'm willing to take my up to 10, 11, maybe even 15% chance, probably closer to 10 to 11% chance. But we have to remember, AML and MDS will ultimately lead to the patient's almost always demise. So we have to really look at that and talk to them. And I start having that conversation well, but beyond before 2 years. So I know what I'm going to do at year 2 and 3. Unfortunately, I don't know the answers, but I have that conversation, do a shared decision.
Exactly. Patient involvement. If the patient wants to be involved, that can really, really be helpful in these really challenging situations. I mean, I'd be, you know, I'm getting back to this case for somebody, you know, somebody's been wanted for 5 years and, you know, they're 84 years old. I would be nervous about their bone marrow, but you also could have a recurrence of ovarian cancer. So if the patient would be involved, that'd be great. Here's another case I was really curious for your feedback on. I was still trying to sort this out with you before we even got started here. So we'll let the audience join in here. So this is a patient of Dr. Rudolph, a young patient, 45 years old, germline BRCA 2. However, the thing that's interesting about her is she had stage 1C. Here's the case.
I have a 45-year-old BRCA2 positive patient who was diagnosed with stage 1C high-grade serous ovarian cancer. She completed total abdominal hysterectomy with the bilateral self-fungal oophorectomy and as an adjuvant therapy had 6 cycles of carboplatin paclitaxel, which she completed about a year ago and is now in complete remission. However, she was very interested right from when she finished her last treatment to consider treatment with PARP inhibitor. She is a well-educated person and felt that she should have the benefit given her young age with a PARP inhibitor. We talked about the trials done in this space, but I would love to know if the experts are actually giving it to younger patients that are BRCA1 or 2 positive. The bigger question really also is, we're using CA125 as a marker for recurrence. What about ctDNA?
The other thing about her that I was kind of curious about is, are you doing anything about her breasts?
So, yes, we have had extensive discussions about consideration of prophylactic bilateral mastectomy. I even sent her to a breast surgeon for it.
So a lot there, and I want to tell you some of the things that Brad and Katie said about this, and some of which I had never heard before. But first, any thoughts about what you've heard so far? Can you kind of straighten us out about, for example, the FDA indication? Because I hear people saying it was stage 3 and 4, like the trials, but I don't see that in the FDA indication. I see that in like in the NCCN guideline, which is another story. But can you kind of separate out like what the FDA says indicated, what was in the trials, what are you doing with stage 2, and what are you doing with stage 1 BRCA?
So let's start with the easiest. The phase 3 trials, every single one of them was stage 3 or 4, what we consider advanced stage. Okay, so all the data is based on stage 3 or 4. The NCCN, which I sat on, as you know, for more than 10 years, we started lumping stage 2 into stage 3 and 4 on the maintenance therapy based on data that stage 2 almost behaved as bad as some of the early stage 3, so 3A. And you have to think that stage 2 is confined to the pelvis. There's no magic divider between the pelvis and abdomen. It's all connected. So it's really, is there really a stage 2? You know, it's probably just earlier stage 3s. And so we lumped those together in the NCCN, but the trials did not include stage 2. The FDA indication does not differentiate advanced stage or metastatic. All they say is in patients with ovarian cancer who received carboplatin paclitaxel, received partial or complete response. So the actually FDA indication does not differentiate which stage. And so we did, we have these discussions, shared decision. And Dr. Rudolph, one other thing is you asked about breast, Neil, but also is let's make sure we get cascade testing. Every single one of her relatives, make sure she gets testing, to your earlier point, right? So right. Cascade testing in germline. Now let's come back to, we had this question because shared decision. We sit down with our patients, you know, stage 2, there's not much data, but the NCCN. Stage 1, you know, small focus, confined, not involving the capsule of the ovary, is probably less than 10% risk of recurrence. But a ruptured tumor, a bunch of tumor on the surface of the ovary, stuck to the sidewall, but maybe the biopsies aren't positive, you know, that's a much higher rate, as high as 20, even 30% if you go to stage 2, risk of recurrence. If the patient recurs, the odds are they succumb to their disease, almost all patients. So we have that discussion with them, should we do anything more? And we have that conversation, and it really now comes down to PARP inhibitors, right? It comes down to, should we use maintenance therapies in these early stage disease with no data? Well, the NCCN said without data, very limited data to no data, that stage 2, sure, let's lump them. But we have that higher risk stage 1 patient, so we wrote it up. And really, really interesting, again, another one of my previous fellows, Dr. Levine. So she looked at all of our patients, and if they're HRD positive in the early stage, they actually had a higher risk recurrence. So there's something there. Now, again, this is retrospective, small numbers, and there's probably some bias there. We tested more people once they recurred. But in that paper, we didn't include it in the findings, but included in the discussion. I think there was 5 patients who had gotten PARP inhibitors. None of those 5 had recurred. 4 or 5, I can't remember. So we didn't put that in the results. Just wasn't enough patients, but we did put it in the discussion because people, you know, the reviewers asked. And so in those patients who got PARP, they didn't recur. So if we have the best therapy, especially in a BRCA patient, BRCA, RAD51 CRD. I'm really counseling them about that. Then how long to treat? Well, I have no data to say I should even treat them. So for how long? No more than 2 years, to your earlier point. Some people would argue a year would be enough. I don't know. I'd probably stick to the data for advanced stage, which is 2 years.
You know, it's really interesting in breast cancer, the way they've always done it, and they have such a long history, though, is they figure out what the hazard rate is. Then they figure out what the absolute risk of, you know, recurrences, and then they apply it, and then they look at the risk and see if it's worth doing. They assume it's going to go all the way down, even if the trial didn't do it. Most of the other solid tumors don't do that. If the trial didn't do it, they don't even do that. But, you know, interesting difference there. One other thing that came out in the discussion that I did not know, and I don't know whether our audience knows, I just thought it was absolutely fascinating, is they were also saying that they've changed the way they do fallopian tube, you know, sterilization. But now they take the whole thing out as a cancer preventive rather than clamping it? Is that the case?
Yeah, we try to do what we call incidental self-injectomy. And I really, any general BGYNs, if you're not doing that, please consider it. So anytime we do a hysterectomy, we used to just go across, and they're preserving their ovaries, and they're preserving their ovaries. We used to just go across, leave the tube and the ovary and go down. We're finding out that many ovarian cancers actually may be fallopian tube cancers. So if we remove those tubes at the time of the hysterectomy, even when we're preserving the ovaries, or at the time of permanent sterility, self-injectomy, that we may be impacting the outcomes of cancer. One of my co-fellow when I was at Yale, Dr. Jessica McAlpin, is now up in Vancouver, looked at this across Canada, and seems that the self-injectomy, incidental self-injectomy, when you're doing that, will decrease the rates of ovarian cancer. So very important for that consideration of for those out of there who do hysterectomies and tie tubes.
All right, I want to try to get through a few more of these cases. I'm going to pick up the case here. Here's a paper that you did looking at recurrence rate in stage 1 and 2. So you can check that out and think about the hazard rate, et cetera, but it's a great paper. Here's another BRCA patient with another issue that came up. This is a 60-year-old patient of Dr. Isawai. Here's the case.
She presented in 2020 with this huge mass shown here. She received debulking. She needed a low anterior section and end-to-end anastomosis, omentectomy, appendectomy, R0. Turns out she has BRCA1 mutation positive, and she's been on maintenance olaparib that had to be dose reduced because of anemia. So the only thing here is anemia with olaparib. What is the optimal procedure in terms of management of anemia with olaparib? And the question pertains to interruption, dose reduction, transfusion.
Yeah, any thoughts in general about the issue? Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, the toxicities of PARP inhibitors, we're still learning about them, right? They're starting to be used in other solid tumors, antiemetics, counsel them about fatigue, sleep-wake cycles, make sure they're eating well, physical therapy, anemia, very common toxicity. Somebody drops down, you know, anybody who starts getting down in the sevens, I dose interrupt, dose reduce. If they're down in the sixes, I transfuse them. Okay, get them back up there and then restart them at a lower dose. I used to be a little bit more cavalier with that. I would transfuse them and try to push the dose. That body is telling me they're not tolerating it. I just go to first dose reduction depending on where they are, and it's pretty straightforward. Interrupt, dose reduce, supportive care, transfusion. I don't do a whole lot of other medical management. Some of my hematologic colleagues could disagree with me, but I really just utilize the dose interruption, reduction, and transfusion as necessary.
So we put a bunch of slides, as we always do, in our slide deck for you to check out, but we're not necessarily going to talk about today, including a bunch I just skipped over on PARP inhibitors, because I want to kind of get into the nitty-gritty of what we always get into, but which seems to change gradually over the years. I mean, Katie was talking about how this really started 2018, so it's like 5 years now that I've been asking you all, like, what do you do? And it gradually seems to me to be changing a little bit, and I want to ask you about this, see if I'm picking this up correctly. And to do that, I want to get into a few of the many questions we put in the survey for you to check out, but just a few of them. But interestingly enough, there's a case in the chat room that I think is going to make the case perfectly, okay? So there's a case that just popped up from Hassan. You tell me what your thoughts are. 55-year-old woman with a PALB2 alteration. I don't know whether it doesn't say germline or somatic. R0 resection, stage 3B, post-adjuvant taxo, carbo. What maintenance would you offer? And actually, that's a lot like what I have up here on the thing.
Exactly.
Patient goes for surgery, no neoadjuvant therapy. Of course, now we're saying PALB2 or BRCA, but this case is PALB2, which incidentally, to me, PALB2 is like BRCA3. I mean, it seems like all the rules apply. Agree?
Yeah, RAD51C or D2. You know, PALB2 is so rare that, you know, we have more data on RAD51C or D. Same thing all applies.
Really?
They all fall within that same thing.
I didn't realize
that. Yep. In ovarian.
In ovarian. So, interesting. So the question here is,
everybody agrees PARP. Like hands down, there's no debate. You know, we're not saving it. We're going to try to cure them. 47.5% probably are cured based on the SOLO-1 data, okay? So let's stop. If you're not offering your patient PARP for a BRCA, PALB2, RAD51-CRD, I would argue you're not adhering to standards of therapy. That doesn't mean the patient has to accept it, but you have to encourage it. And then, okay. Now, the only debate here is BEV. Now, we've talked about this, and this is the data Apollo-1, a light bulb went out, clarity became, right? Okay. So I saw it. Everybody gets BEV. There's no such thing as a low-risk advanced stage ovarian cancer. Let's get over that, okay? They have an 80-85% chance that cancer is going to kill them. 80-85% chance that cancer is going to kill them as a stage 3A or 3B. Doesn't really move. So we wrote a patient, again, with Dr. Laura Chambers, Herzog, and Coleman, that there is no low-risk advanced ovarian cancer. So I'm not going to deny any one of my patients the best therapy. And if I think BEV is the best therapy, I'm going to give it. I'm going to give it in the first-line therapy. And then I'm going to do the germline somatic testing. Go ahead.
Well, yeah, I was just going to ask you whether or not we actually, have clear-cut evidence that you get an extra benefit when you add BEV1 to a PARP inhibitor in a germline situation or a BRCA situation.
We don't. We got cross-trial comparison, maybe a 10% increased risk. And that's why I said the only debatable here is BEV. So as always, Neil, you call me on my crap. I love it. No, there's not definitive evidence, but we do have cross-trial comparison. No, it's great. I'm teasing you, as you know.
I asked Katie and because I started here, and I think I've heard it from you too in the last few months. Like, I asked them, who do you not give BEV to? And they were like, people who won't accept it. I mean, who are you not giving BEV to right now?
In my practice, and I admit, I don't know all the answers, but this point of clarity, the data is clear. I give BEV to everybody who's advanced stage. Do I give it everybody stage 2? No, but everybody stage 3 or above, I give it. And then I utilize that. Now, if this patient started to have proteinuria, started having hypertension, we added a third medication, I'm dropping the BEV before I go to that third medication. Okay, olaparib is clearly the most important in a PALB2, BRCA1, 1-2, or RAD51-CRD patient. Clearly, olaparib is the best patient. So if I start to have toxicities, the BEV, I drop it. Katie and I, you know, she said 15 months. She's included the chemotherapy. My 1 year is my maintenance. So we're both saying the same thing there. Katie and I are doing the same thing. Dr. Moore.
And, you know, when experienced investigators, you know, say this kind of thing, you know, it means a lot because we don't see the trial exactly telling us that. But the fact that you believe it enough to offer it to patients is very helpful. And interestingly, another thing they brought up in whether or not to consider BEV, this came up at the last webinar. Somebody asked in the chat room with the KLEM thing, the velocity of CA-125 dropping, that they could incorporate that if it drops fast, maybe they don't use the BEV. And so do you use that? I mean, that's kind of a cool thing, the velocity of how quickly the CA-125 drops.
It's cool, though we don't have any data that we should hold off therapy based on the KLEM data, right? We can use it as a prognostic indicator, but we're not there for treatment. So again, the reason I kind of made fun of myself there, but I'm taking this data from Apollo-1 exploratory analysis, clearly exploratory analysis. But when we look at the curves, and this paper's not out yet, last year's ESGO, they presented the follow-up data in Apollo-1, the low risk versus high risk. 90% of the low risk patients HRD positive using olaparib in BEV didn't recur, like 90%. The hazard ratio, I think, was 0.1. Now, that's not a publication yet. It was presented at a conference most of us don't attend, ESGO, right? As a European Society of Gynecological Oncology. But that data shows the mature data. We are 100% should be using our best therapies for those who have the best chance to be cured of their disease, those with the lower risk. why are we holding therapy? And so for me, the clarity is there. Bev for everybody, plus minus olaparib. And if their HRD test negative, I continue the Bev. I don't add a PARP inhibitor at that point. And I think, oh no, that's LOH high, sorry.
And you know, here it is. And actually here, so first of all, BRCA wild type at LOH high, everybody does sort of the same thing, which kind of tells me people are starting to believe in the LOH score. But this is, of course, what everybody wants to know. And actually, Kamal in the chat room asked about patients with non-BRCA. Incidentally, Kamal was given great questions all day long on Saturday from the chat room. I don't know where that person is, but in any event, but here's the one that people have a lot of questions about, including Kamal, BRCA wild type, LOH low. And you can see there are still a couple people saying niraparib. You and Katie say Bev, and I guess you've already kind of explained what your thinking is. There's another question actually in the chat room. Deborah says, would you put a patient back on a PARP, I guess in this case olaparib, after recurrence? Patient did not recur while on the PARP, but this is now several years later. And we asked, what, you know, of course, now we have the FDA prohibition on treatment of recurrence. But we said, what are the situations where you will use a PARP inhibitor in recurrent disease? And you can see that even though it's not FDA approved, and I don't know whether how easy or hard it is to actually access it, but everybody has a scenario, either PARP naive, well, mainly PARP naive and responding to platinum, as you're saying here, but particularly with some type of HRD situation. Can you comment on that?
Yeah, so again, more data coming out of the Apollo 1, which is really, really interesting. They just presented, again, I think it was at ESCO, but I don't have that in front of me. So I'll just kind of talk in general terms. But last year at ESCO, we talked about with Philip Harder, you know, where if somebody progressed on PARP versus progressed after PARP and then looked at the response to platinum in the next line of therapy. And they compared it to those patients never received PARP. And the patients who had never received PARP and their response to platinum were the same as those that did not progress. So great question from the chat. I think there are two different types of patients who received previous PARP. There's a PARP resistant who progressed, which I would not go back to a PARP unless it's part of a clinical trial and they're going to be there will be getting another agent that is going to try to overcome PARP resistant. But I think the other patient we need to consider is that patient who had completed their 2 or 3 years of therapy, had a disease-free interval and has now returned, particularly if they have a good response to platinum. I absolutely would consider that. There's not that many patients out there, but absolutely the patient progresses on PARP is much different than the patient who was previously on it then stopped. Previously stopped because of toxicity or because they've completed their course of therapy. Very different patients, and I think we need to look at them very differently. Now, the extreme responders paper, I got an amazing amount of feedback and already, you know, citations about the AML and MDS rate, right? That's really exciting. Maybe the most important thing that comes out of that paper. But the other thing that came out of that paper, which we have to look at, is outside of BRCA and RAD51 CRD, the clinical features were more important than the molecular features. What do I mean by the clinical features? If they respond to platinum, if they had a complete response, they normalized their C125, they had no measurable disease on CAT scan, and or a long platinum-free interval, all of those things predicted patients who would do much better with a PARP inhibitor. Now, that's a different scenario. Those are patients who did not have PARP. So I think those are two different scenarios. Both of them I would consider treatment with a PARP in the platinum-sensitive maintenance setting.
So I want to see if we can get through a couple more cases. This next one, really, when I heard it, I thought a lot about you because I knew you've been so involved in the research on Tumor Treating Fields. And this is a 64-year woman who actually had that therapy.
This patient was randomized to weekly paclitaxel plus the Tumor Treating Field device. And she actually was doing really well in terms of response. She had partial response to the therapy, but unfortunately, she had very significant skin toxicity related to the arrays. But I am curious for the members of the panel who have used the Tumor Treating Fields device, what sort of toxicity have you witnessed in your patients? Have you found it to be prohibitive? Because it's just so much different, you know, when you're treating a torso as opposed to wearing, you know, a skull cap for GBM management. And do you feel like this is a treatment that could potentially move forward in selected cases in patients with ovarian cancer? Obviously, the goal is to try to keep the arrays on as much as possible in a 24-hour period. But if the skin toxicity is severe, then patients are allowed to take a break from their arrays. You know, I think it's an excellent concept and obviously has shown improvement in outcomes for patients with glioblastoma. Do you feel like this is something that could be efficacious in a disease that is much more widespread, perhaps, than a GBM?
And I'm curious, too, about your general thoughts, you know, looking at this slide on the mechanism of action, what your thoughts are about that. Also, the trial design that preceded this phase 3 study that unfortunately just very, very recently was reported to be negative. We saw a positive phase 3 trial in Tumor Treating Fields on non-small cell lung cancer, although people still trying to figure out what that means. But I know you've been very involved with the research on this. Curious what your thoughts are about the cases, about this new method of treatment. Also, her questions about the tolerability issues.
Yeah, so a great question. Lindsay's brilliant and a good friend. Unfortunately, we do have only the press release. It has not yet been presented. Only the press release that it was negative for its primary outcome, which was overall survival. There's going to be a lot more that's going to be coming out about that data, and obviously we'll look forward to get the manuscript out. So, you know, I think there is definitely something there. Clearly there is with regards to, as you said, non-small lung cancer being positive, trying to tease out what's the right. It should be immune therapy or should be or cytotoxic to combine with it. Clearly there is efficacy here. And can we identify a group of patients that will benefit it from NGYN cancers? The skin toxicity is real, and she brings up some great points, which is, you know, putting on your scalp, which doesn't have that friction, doesn't have that rubbing, is going to be much different than putting on a torso. So we learned a lot in the trial, and we're going to put together a publication really talks about the skin toxicity and some best practices and some interventions that we can have. But we learned a lot. It is tolerable, but we need to continue to be more proactive with our mitigation strategies as we move forward in the development of this technology. If it doesn't develop and go forward in ovary, it's going to hopefully, it will have a role in thoracic. And I think it's similar challenges with the skin toxicity. It's probably not as much as abdomen because, again, you don't have as much shearing and moving, but the toxicities and the skin, the interventions, the mitigation strategies, we've learned a lot. And I think in the future, we would be able to mitigate those to make it much more tolerable, as well as the technology advances.
Yeah, I think pancreas also is another one that's being looked at. I've heard that now there's smaller arrays that maybe are going to be less irritating or something. They've changed the physical thing.
Absolutely, and that's exactly what I meant. As the technology improves, really the technology.
And the battery is smaller.
Well, the battery is smaller, which is good because of the smaller pack you have to carry. It's bad because it doesn't last as long. You know, so again, a smaller pack you can probably put on your waist is going to probably become in the future. It really is there. Yeah, exactly, right?
You know, get yourself charged up.
Get that in there and go. I mean, it's really, you know, you think about this and you go, okay, if we can figure out how to, with electric currents, impact cancer in something that you can wear across different treatments, there's something there. Again, in the arrays get better, and potentially the science, the technology, the frequency that we treat them at, all of these things are going to help us as we move forward.
So final case, a young patient again, 52 years old, multiply recurrent disease, actually a germline BRCA, but also FR-alpha positive, who's going to be the first patient that Dr. Schneider gives mirvetuximab to. Here are her questions.
I think the big thing for all of us with all of these antibody drug conjugates are the ocular side effects. You know, for most of us, that is not something we have ever had to think about. She is diabetic, so she already has an ophthalmologist. This particular patient is very on board with whatever we suggest. She's also extremely compliant which I think is very important, especially trying a new drug early on. You know, you want people that will report side effects. So she was okay and happy doing the drug, even knowing that this is a new drug for us and for everybody in the infusion center.
Any questions about managing people, you know, ophthalmic issues?
This is one of the few side effects that we have no training in dealing with. You know, the most of us can listen to heart and lungs and do all of that, but the majority of, at least in our world, the eye is a completely foreign structure that we do not know how to handle that. Our cancer center does not have ophthalmologists or optometrists. So there's not, you know, somebody within our hospital system that can, we can refer these patients to. I assume with the new treatment for cervical cancer and the trial coming out that it was positive yesterday and clearly showing a benefit, I assume a lot of these antibody drug conjugates are probably going to be developed. Are people hiring optometrists? That's a lot of visits.
Can you do question. It yourself? This is a great paper you did specifically on this. Maybe you can go through. But first, any comments about her questions?
Well, this is a great start, right? Dr. Hendershot and Dr. Slaubau are ophthalmologists at Ohio State. And they're two people I worked with while we're developing and testing MERV in the very earlier. So I had these relationships, right? And part of the trial, we had to get those. So, you know, as funny as when they went off trial, I had to kind of relearn what I was going to do. I just couldn't send everybody to the ophthalmology cancer program, right? So I had to like, okay, this person already has an optometrist or ophthalmologist. So Imugen actually developed this really nice kind of checkbox list of things they need to, that the ophthalmologist or optometrist need to do. Now, we're not allowed to have anything that has the company's name on it. So we basically just made our own. We literally hand a copy to the patient to say, take this to your ophthalmologist and bring it back to us or fax it to us through my chart. So what we've done is to say, okay, if you already have somebody established, let's use them. Let's send them back with information about the drug and what they need. And then if they start to have toxicities, then I take it to the next level. The ophthalmologist at the academic center, the ophthalmologist who has an interest in ADCs. So I use my local care eye specialist, but then I will escalate if they start to have issues or problems to somebody who has more experience with the ADCs. And these are across solid tumors as well as liquid tumors. You know, I don't have to tell you, Neil. I mean, these are toxicities which we will see more and more as we move forward across our solid tumor patient population. And we're just going to have to get comfortable at least partnering with eye care specialists.
So yeah, I was mentioning we did an entire program just on ophthalmologic oncology, because this comes up, not just ADCs like erdafitinib, a bunch of other agents. So oncology continues to be more and more interesting. And thank you so much, Dave. It's always a pleasure to talk to you. There's so many more things we could be talking about. Have a great time there at ESMO. I'm curious how the tisotumab data, you know, I was wondering, you put ice packs on people's eyes who get tisotumab?
Yeah, we still do. We still do. We put them right there. We have to put it on the order set, and they have them coming out for us.
And that doesn't work with mirvetuximab?
We haven't tried it with MIRV. You know, MIRV is a corneal thing, and tisotumab vedotin is a conjunctiva thing. So because those are two different mechanisms, I'm not sure it'd benefit patients with MIRV.
Yeah, well, like Dr. Schneider, my remembering the anatomy of the eye maybe isn't the best at this point. Anyhow, thanks a lot, Dave. Audience, thank you for attending. Coming back next Tuesday. Always a great time to spend with Dr. Rabose talking about AML and MDS. Be safe, stay well, and have a great night. Thanks so much, Dave. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.